BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's 811 days since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And right across Ukraine, many people have an app called Air Alert, which notifies them when there's an air raid in their region, and they'll hear this.
Attention, air raid alert. Proceed to the nearest shelter. Don't be careless. Your overconfidence is your weakness.
And in Kharkiv, Ukraine's second city, people living there in recent months have really become accustomed to hearing that alert.
And things have got worse for Kharkiv over the past few days, because over the weekend, Russian forces made small but tactically significant gains right along the border, which is around 45 miles from Kharkiv,
yeah.
Just an hour's drive.
It feels alarming, doesn't it?
It does feel alarming, because even though Russians may not be able to capture the actual city, if they're close enough to it, they may be able to make it unlivable using artillery.
So today on the podcast, we're going to explore exactly what's happening in and around Kharkiv and whether Russia has now launched its summer offensive.
This is Ukrainecast.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.
Evil cannot be trusted. Ask Prigozhin.
You are not dealing with a politician, but with a bloody monster.
Is there a need for a serious opponent? Why?
Ukraine is unbroken, unbowed, and unconquered.
It's not just about Ukraine. It's about the whole future of Europe.
I don't understand what this war is for.
Hello, this is Victoria Derbyshire in the Ukrainecast studio.
And this is Vitaly Shevchenko, also in the Ukrainecast studio.
And back with us today, Mark Galliotti. Hi, Mark.
Hello there.
Mark is an honorary professor at University College London and the author of several books on Russian history, most recently Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. So, Mark, we'll get your take on what's happening. Vitaly, first of all, just remind our listeners who are all around the world where exactly is Kharkiv and how close it is to the Russian border in the north.
Kharkiv, Ukraine's second biggest city, almost 1.5 million people lived there before the war. It's very close to the Russian border, which makes it such a prized target for the Russians, about an hour's drive. And over the weekend, Russian reconnaissance groups or scouting groups, together with armoured vehicles, tried to break through that border and advance towards Kharkiv. They've entered a town near Kharkiv called Vovchansk, which makes it really bad for Ukraine.
Yeah. And we've got some footage, it is said, to show Ukraine's State Border Guard Service facing attacks in the first few minutes of the Russian offensive in Kharkiv. Have a listen and then we'll describe it for you.
So it shows people, presumably Ukrainians, in a forest, in a kind of in a dugout.
In trenches, essentially.
In trenches, and one of them whispers, "Oh, look, there. And then there's a shout, "Oh, who's there?" And then all hell breaks loose. There's firing and basically a battle ensues.
Yeah. Does it appear that the Ukrainians were caught off guard there or what? Because the reason I say that is because troops in Kharkiv told the BBC's defence correspondent Jonathan Beale, "There was no first line of defence. We saw it. The Russians just walked in. They just walked in without any mind feels."
Oh, they knew this was a possibility. They knew, right, Russians were massing along the border. It's a question of being prepared in terms of defences and weapons to fight the Russians with.
Mark, what is your take on what's happened here and why it's happening?
Well, I mean, first of all, just to deal with that point about the Russian capacity just to sort of march across the border, It's a very, very long border. It's impossible to fortify, to garrison, or indeed to lay mines across the whole range. So in some ways, there was a certain inevitability about that. As you say, the Ukrainians knew that forces were massing. In the modern sort of day and age of the panopticon society, nothing happens that can't be spotted. But there's always that question of not knowing exactly which route they take and when. Now, to me, this is not about taking Kharkiv. I mean, this is basically the consensus of those observers. There just aren't enough troops for that. And frankly, it would be quite a distraction and diversion of Russian forces, which are engaged in a variety of operations along the sort of direct Luhansk and Donetsk regional borders. So what this is actually an attempt precisely to drain Ukrainian resources to the north. Because let's be honest, Kyiv can't just simply sit back and just see what happens. They have to defend Kharkiv. The point is exactly about keeping the Russians beyond artillery range of the city. So essentially, if they can get within about 30 kilometres, then they have brought the city under so-called fire control.
PK on Discord asks this. Are Russian forces overstretching themselves with the new fronts and the intensity of their aerial bombardments? And Sasha on Discord asks, is this offensive by Russia a panic push before more ammunition and air defence arrives for Ukraine?
Can I tackle the first question? In terms of aerial bombardments, I'm sure you'll agree, Mark, the Russians have a lot of artillery shells, which are not really precise, but really cheap, but they have many more of them than expensive and precise missiles. So if they are within artillery range of Kharkiv, they're not going to be overstretching themselves. They're just going to be able to lob those shells at Kharkiv and make it unlivable.
And I'd agree with that. And I'd also add, I mean, more broadly, this is not a large deployment of troops.
Right.
This is the point. They have this kind of capacity. At the moment, they're still taking advantage, not just of the fact that they have more ammunition, but also at present, they have more troops.
So to Sasha's point, is it a panic push before the ammunition and the air defences arrive for Ukraine?
I wouldn't say it's a panic push. I mean, I think it is the Russians are absolutely aware that they have a window of opportunity in which they have more of an advantage than they will later in the year. And therefore, it's worth moving now. But unfortunately, although it would be nice to think of it as some kind of panic response, I think actually it's part of the overall strategic approach. They are trying to stretch the Ukrainians so that they can make some further advances to the south.
Yeah.
Overall, is it working?
We wait and see. I mean, look, they are grinding forward in their main offensives because precisely they have at the moment the advantage of deeper magazines and more troops. And frankly, I think unfortunately this year, they're going to continue to have something of an advantage and there will be more bad news. But whether or not this particular approach works, we're really going to have to see. It's too early to decide whether or not the Ukrainians are going to have to send substantial forces there. And if so, what effect this will have on the other battlefields.
So is this it? Is this the start of Russia's offensive, the summer offensive, or you know, the spring offensive? Has it begun?
Look, I don't think we can really compartmentalize it into specific offensives. I mean, from the Russians' point of view, they have already been attacking and they will be continuing to attack as long as they absolutely can. There may be phases of particular higher intensity, but essentially, instead of thinking of anything else, we should think of it, frankly, this is the Russians' 2024 offensive.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk now to a teacher who, until yesterday, lived in Kharkiv, Olesya Fedyuko. Hi, Olesya. Can you hear us?
Hello, Jan.
Hi. Thank you very much for joining us here on Ukrainecast.
Привет, Олеся.
Доброго дня.
So tell us why you moved out of the city yesterday.
I'm a bit scared about my children because the area is small. I'm not very far from Kharkiv. I'm in a Kharkiv region. And to tell the truth, I hope to go to my working hour, as we call it, metro school, because I have a lesson on Monday, and I hope to leave my children with my mom and to go and work.
So what is the metro school?
Yeah, it's a school in a tube.
So on the underground.
The underground, yeah.
Because Kharkiv is one of the few Ukrainian cities which has the metro system.
Yeah.
So can I ask you, Olesya, what is the situation in Kharkiv now? What's changed that made you think, okay, we're leaving?
I think maybe there are not so many people, maybe like a month ago, but everything works. People go to their works, but because they have small children, I wanted to leave Kharkiv and to go to my mom to sit with them, and I hope to come back and work.
And your children, I think, are 4 and 8, Olesya.
Yeah.
How do your children feel?
They are very optimistic.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. They wanted to go home, but they understand. I think they are very adult, not for their age. Mm. They are talking like adults, and they, I think they understand even more than they could.
How many of your friends, family, colleagues are also either considering leaving or have left?
My husband is in Kharkiv because he needs to work. My friends, maybe half of them have already moved.
Right.
And all my friends also have children, and they, I think it maybe in this moment it's better to move somewhere.
Do you want to go back? I assume you do.
I want everything be okay, and we want to go home, because home is home.
Do you get a sense of déjà vu, maybe? Does it feel similar to the way the war started? It was really, really bad back then. I remember all those horrible images of missiles hitting central squares in Kharkiv, and a lot of people left, and then they came back, and now some people are leaving as well. Do you think it's all repeating itself?
I must agree. It's a very similar situation that was in 2022, because mm-hmm. I moved from Kharkiv, and then I came back, and everything, can't say that everything was okay, but it's... was normal for us,
sure.
But now it's some kind of situations that is repeated like in 2022.
Alessia, thank you very much for talking to us on Ukrainecast, and take care, and we'll catch up with you soon if that's okay.
Thank you.
Дуже дякуємо. Тримайтеся.
Дякую.
Mark, you're still with us, and as we are recording, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is in Ukraine for a surprise visit, an unannounced visit. Here, he is meeting President Zelensky in Kyiv, talking about that recent $61 billion military aid package.
Thank you so much. Thanks for coming to Ukraine, especially these days. Not simple period for Ukraine. Also, I wanted to thank you from all my team, all Ukrainians, to... crucial package for our forces, for our warriors. Thank you so much for this package.
This is a challenging time, but we also know that in the near term, the assistance is now on the way. Some of it's already arrived. More of it will be arriving. And that's going to make a real difference against the ongoing Russian aggression on the battlefield.
So, Mark, what is Antony Blinken doing in Kyiv? Is it merely a symbolic gesture? Is this all they can do after all these delays, just to go to Kyiv and say, well, look, aid is on the way?
I think there is a great deal to that. I think it's also, in some ways, Blinken has to go to help support the process of actually, you know, the negotiations and the deal-making as to exactly how the aid arrives, where it's being spent, how it's being used, and so forth. The American administration is at the moment deeply paranoid about any potential suspicion of corruption and diversion, which in fairness, we haven't really seen at this level. But nonetheless, it's one of the talking points that are constantly mobilized against aid to the Ukrainians.
Can I interrupt you
there? Sure.
I've been writing an article for the BBC about corruption in Ukraine, and I've been speaking to government officials, Transparency International, local Ukrainian anti-corruption activists, and all of them are saying it's impossible to steal Western military aid sent to Ukraine.
Exactly. I mean, look, we've seen a little bit of diversion, as you'd imagine, of small arms and basically anything that can be stuck in the boot of a car. But anything larger than that, anything more substantial, no. I mean, it's very carefully inventoried and so forth. But this is it. But I think, in a way, there has to be, from the American side, not only a performative show of support for the Ukrainians, but also, in some ways, it's a sign of reassurance back home that we are on top of what's going on.
We also heard this morning from General Sir Richard Sheriff, NATO's former Deputy Supreme Commander in Europe, who said that the West's approach to funding Ukraine's war effort needed to radically change.
The strategy, such as it is, of giving Ukraine only enough to defend itself is not going to achieve success for Ukraine. It's certainly not going to achieve Ukraine's war aims, and ultimately it's not going to achieve Western security. The only thing that will do that is if there is a fundamental strategy shift that says that we, the West, need to give Ukraine the capabilities to defeat Russia in Ukraine.
Is it going to change?
Well, it's not going to be easy, given all the fears and misgivings and threats flying around, with Russia saying, we are so ready to press the nuclear button if we have to, you won't believe it. And it's been working. And here we have people talking about how this needs to change and how the West needs to be braver. But what does that mean? Allowing Ukraine to use Western-supplied missiles or whatever to hit targets inside Russia, deploying trainers, instructors on the ground, or actual boots on the ground.
Well, it's not going to be boots on the ground, is it? We know that.
Well, some people are saying it's got to be done. And they're saying, well, look, this is how Second World War was won.
Sure.
So it's necessary from Ukraine's point of view, but from the Western point of view, oh, it's so dangerous.
Well, to give more military hardware, why is that dangerous? Mark, do come in on this. As Richard Sharif says, it's sort of never quite enough. It's never quite enough. It's potentially enough to hold Russian troops at bay for a little while, but never to win back enough territory for it to be significant. Mark, what's your take?
Look, I think there's an element of mythology about this idea that it's just enough to stop Ukraine from being defeated. First of all, we tend to focus almost obsessively on the hardware. And obviously, that's really important, especially when it comes to ammunition. But it's also about manpower. Mm. And at the moment, actually, although the Ukrainians have passed a new law in terms of allowing them to mobilize a wider range of people, you know, until that manpower is actually available at the front, then the kit is only part of the equation. Secondly, look, the bottom line is this. It's not really about fear that Putin's going to go nuclear or whatever. There's no real belief that that is actually a serious claim at the moment. It's rather that it's all about money. I mean, there is a clear sense that although we are spending billions of pounds, dollars and euros every month in supporting Ukraine, not just in terms of military kit, but also in supporting its economy, no politician really is that comfortable at saying, we will not spend money on roads or health or education or whatever else, or we will borrow yet more money. Here, I'm going to be playing devil's advocate for a moment, so bear with me. It's also that, in fact, there is no massive groundswell of people saying, stop spending money on X, but spend it on Ukraine. I mean, we have to recognize that. And also, in fairness, there are many wars around the world that we have done nothing about. So, yes, of course, you know, this is absolutely tragic for Ukraine. But nonetheless, you know, we actually have to recognize that there are political constraints. It's not just simply because we're timorous or because we're afraid of Putin's rhetoric or whatever. It is actually that there's a delicate balance at maintaining this multinational coalition, which frankly has done an extraordinary job, ranging from the sanctions regime, which after all has cost us a lot of money, all the way through to the assistance for Ukraine. Yes, we could always do more. And absolutely, there are all kind of places in which we should be doing more. But it's all very well doing that. We also actually have to sometimes stop a moment and just say, frankly, no one at the beginning of this war believed that the West would be so united, so generous and so consistent in its support for Ukraine.
That is a very fair point.
Not necessarily speedy.
Well, democratic governments don't do speed. Alas, that is one of the problems, that authoritarian regimes can be much more nimble in this respect.
Let's talk about the authoritarian regime in Russia, because there's been a reshuffle in the Kremlin. Vitaly, briefly, what happened over the weekend?
The defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, who had been in a job for 12 years, is out. He was moved to the job of the Russian Security Council secretary, not necessarily the biggest job there is. In a hugely surprising move, the new Russian defense minister, Andrei Belousov, is an economist. He's an accountant. He's a bean counter. And now he's overseeing Russia's war machine. That raised a lot of eyebrows. Did it raise your eyebrows, Mark?
Or did it make sense?
It manages to do both. No one had thought that Belousov was one of the likely front runners to replace Shoigu, even though there was a sense that Shoigu's time was up. He has been, let's be honest, a catastrophically bad wartime defense minister. But the point is, the job of the defense minister is not to be a soldier. That's what the chief of the general staff is for, particularly in time of war. actually the defence minister's job is an administrative one. It's to make sure that the resources are there for the soldiers. And in that respect, actually, Belousov's appointment makes a lot of sense. And it signals the way that the Russian state is basically digging in for the long haul. You know, someone who's an economist, who thinks that the state should be having more control over the economy, which we're definitely going to be seeing. We're almost seeing a bit of a rollback to the old planned economy of Soviet times. And someone who's a government insider, who's not a Putin crony, but someone whom Putin trusts.
A loyalist.
So in this respect, it's actually quite alarming. He's absolutely a loyalist. But then again, no one at the top of the system can dare to be anything but a loyalist.
Putin and Shoigu, pretty good mates, weren't they? Did the odd bit of mushroom picking together, the odd fishing trip. I mean, does that friendship continue or was that fake anyway?
Well, with Putin, you never know what's real, what's not, whether he likes you or not.
You'd always be looking over your shoulder, wouldn't you, if you're in his...
And in Sergei Shoigu's case, it means that you can go to Siberia to do your mushroom picking for as long as you want, and it doesn't make you safe. It doesn't mean that you're going to keep a job. At the end of the day, there's only one man in Russia who decides, and that's Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin. So it's a massive reshuffle, definitely the biggest reshuffle since the full-scale invasion began. Yeah. But all these people, Belousov, Shoigu, Patrushev, they answer to just one man.
Yeah. Forgive me for mentioning this. It's really, really superficial in the scheme of things, as you are about to find out. There is video of Putin and Shoigu fishing together. President Putin shirtless, topless. Why did he do that?
Macho. He shoves off his body and his image. He's in control.
His physique's not that great.
Well, yeah, a lot of people have been talking about the echoes of Brokeback Mountain and all that. But at the end of the day, he likes the optics of himself leading Shoigu into the Siberian forests or whatever.
Right. Okay.
And Shoigu was always clever enough to let Putin take the limelight. I mean, again, I think one thing we have to say is that Shoigu has a pretty good track record of knowing how to, I wouldn't want to say manipulate, but let's say play the boss.
Right.
And that is, in a personalistic system like this, that is a crucial political asset.
That's how he stayed in the job for
12 years. Yeah, exactly. Mark, thank you so much for your insight. As always, we really appreciate it here on Ukrainecast. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Mark.
And while the current US Secretary of State is in Kyiv as we record this episode, the former US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, Donald Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, will be with us on Ukrainecast this Friday. I know you will have many questions for him, so do get your questions and your comments into
us. And I know you know how to send them to us, which is via WhatsApp, Telegram or Signal using the usual number, +44 330 123 9480. Or the usual email address, which is ukrainecast@bbc.co.uk.
I wonder if he's watching former President Trump's trial in New York as we speak. Anyway, wherever you are listening in the world, take care.
Goodbye.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.